Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, April 8th, 2022. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week, Rabble's national politics reporter Stephen Wentzel reported on the Don't Say Gay bill set to go in effect in Florida on July 1st. The legislation, formerly known as the Parental Rights in Education Bill, will prevent teachers from educating young children about gender identity and sexual orientation. The bill has been panned by advocates, politicians, and corporations alike. Wentzel spoke to queer advocates in Canada. They all expressed the same concern. How will this bill impact education on gender diversity and sexual orientation for Canadian children? Debbie Owusu-Icha shares her analysis in this week's interview. Owusu-Icha has been the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity since July 2020. The CCGSD is a national LGBTQ organization dedicated to eliminating all forms of bullying, discrimination, and homophobia in schools. She and Wentzel dive into why it's so important for media organizations to share spaces for queer advocates and experts in queer and gender studies, especially in the light of the recent headlines coming out of the US. Could a similar Don't Say Gay legislation actually happen in Canada? Here are Owusu-Icha and Wentzel in conversation. Take a listen.
To get started, Debbie, let's just dive right in. I'm wondering if you could give me your first impression to this parental rights and education bill that's been pushed all the way through to being passed in Florida.
From my understanding of this, you know, I've been following for a while now, both within this role, but even beforehand, knowing that like anti-LGBTQ legislation of all sorts is like as American as like Big Macs, like I feel like every day there's a different threat to us LGBTQ livelihood, but specifically trans people. And then on the other side, young queer and trans people. So it's almost just like these two groups, and obviously there's an overlap, tend to have the biggest of the witch hunt. Cisgender, gay and lesbian, bisexual people still are impacted by legislation and rhetoric around us somehow grooming young people, but the threat isn't as elevated as what we're seeing directed towards trans people in different states in America, but then also the use of youth as part of the witch hunt. And I think it's because young people, and we see this here in Canada, so I cannot wait to talk about it in the Canadian context, young people are and children are just easy way to garner public opinion on anything. Anything that's constructed as a threat to young people, it matters because you don't want to be seen as the person who thinks that threatening young underage people is a good thing. And so for right-wing pundits or part of right-wing rhetoric, it has benefited them politically to focus on young people. And so education becomes a very interesting institution to do so. And a lot of the work that CCGSD does is on the education side. So we can definitely talk to you about what's been happening here. Young people spend majority of their time in schools. And if we look back at American history, especially through the Cold War, and I think the war in Ukraine and the propaganda we're seeing now, it's like timely. A lot of the language of like influencing, negative influencing, communist type influencing, that very like, let's not have that, and pushing back against it with American values, which always goes back to the hegemonic family structure, the way gender is supposed to be done in a binary. We see that as being the thing that pushes against progress, because progress is seen as a threat to the most powerful people. And any attempt to make education progressive, to change cultures long-term, and young people's are needing to start, it all just fits within their, I would call their toolbox in terms of rhetoric. That's extremely powerful, especially in the state of Florida or many states we see. So with this Don't Say Gay bill for a curriculum, it's so easy for them to kind of frame it as young people, or specifically the ages that they've, or the grades that they talk about, it's too young for them to talk about gender. It's too young for them to talk about sexuality. They don't know, which I think it's super important for us to state the fact that there's been research done that they aren't that young to talk about diversity in relationships, diversity in bodies, diversity in understanding. It's actually beneficial to introduce these things to young people. But if you're someone who benefits from that information not being accessible to young people, and I will argue white children, and I'll talk about the white supremacist elements tied to that, you, of course, don't want to see that happen. And so that's kind of what I kind of understand what's happening now with this. I understand the backlash, and I understand the legitimate fears as someone leading a youth-led organization in Canada on what this might mean for Canadian politics. And I'll go back to the white children element, because I often talk about how we can't address homophobia and transphobia without talking about white supremacy, because there is still some very weird theories within on the right about, you know, white replacement, and that somehow there's some big scheme to reduce the white population through trans people existing and through gay people living their best lives. And so this all kind of fits in with this threat, again, the broader picture and story in America, that the white Judeo-Christian majority is somehow threatened by these progressive thoughts, these progressive ways of seeing things, and that young people can't be corrupted. And I often say that history is a great teacher and provider of context. We've seen this before. And I think the Cold War era has taught us all of the lessons we need to know about how education and trying to stop certain ways of thinking as a threat to young people. We've seen it before. I just wish we were more prepared to push against it, essentially.
Totally. And I think you mentioned grooming, and I think that it's really important to mention that the reality of this is that young children aren't asking about sex. They're asking about love, and mm-hmm. they're trying to understand different types of love. I'm wondering if you could kind of bring that into the Canadian context of how bills like this that we see in Florida could impact our Canadian schools.
Absolutely. Whew, where do I begin? So I'll first start off, because I think you said something very beautiful about young people aren't asking about sex. They're asking about love and wanting to see the diversity of that being displayed. Oftentimes in these conversations that adults are having about children, never consider young people having agency. And I think that's the problem. These conversations never consider that youth have agency on their own bodies, especially when we're talking about trans youth, and also have agency in what they want to learn. Oftentimes they forget that it's young people, and I'll bring it to, and I'll weave this into the Canadian context. A lot of the times when CCGSD is brought into a classroom across, in a school across Canada, it is because the students have asked to see diversity in thought, perspective, and experiences be reflected, because it's not being seen in the mainstream curriculum. Or if it is, it's done in a way that these young people who I say are, we have a lot to learn from them. I'm a younger millennial, but these Gen Zers can like run laps around me on like what's being discussed and like thinking of ideas. And so they are the ones who are displaying the agency and what they would like to see and hear and learn. And I think that's absent in this conversation when adults are saying what young people can and cannot learn, which I think is disrespectful. In the Canadian context, I like to use this phrase a lot because I think it's funny, but Canada's in the import-export business of ideology, and hate is one of them. I live here in Ottawa, not too far from downtown, and I think February is a prime example of showing that just because something is happening directly at south of the border and maybe dominating conversations around legislation doesn't mean it doesn't have a direct impact here. Canada and the US share a lot of similar things, and part of those similar things are upholding the status quo. And part of upholding that status quo is like white supremacist, homophobic, transphobic ideology that permeates every element of our culture. And so when we think about education, and I'll bring it to the context of the province of Ontario because I live here, we saw this as soon as the Ford government was elected. One of the first things that they wanted to address was the sex ed curriculum that the Liberal provincial government had in since 2015. And part of the rhetoric, and we saw it, youth are too young, it's grooming young people, it's inappropriate, let's go back to a sex ed curriculum that I did back in like 2000 when we didn't have social media, where we weren't talking about consent. And I went to Catholic school. So if we're going to talk about even the difference between publicly funded Catholic versus publicly funded non-religious, I wasn't seeing the relationships that I'm now in as an adult being reflected in what was being taught. God forbid they mention the fact that romantic feelings can exist on a continuum. That wasn't happening at all. Different bodies weren't being talked about. And so it is so easy, especially since we're seeing a global pushback to progressive movements. It's across the entire globe. It is so easy for that to happen in Canada. One, because those thoughts exist here. We've seen it. We've seen it very intimately. And I try to tell people this at the other level. The United States has like national kind of conversations on education. I forget her name. Is it Betsy DeVos? That education.
Unfortunately, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, right. That education role exists at a national level. We don't have that in Canada. We're so stuck on this jurisdiction thing. And I saw the perfect like King of the Hill meme about it on the Instagram page, where you know the provinces and the federal government. It's like, it's your problem, not my problem. We don't have a national strategy around education at all. So what ends up happening is that provinces get to do what they want to do with education, which makes it so much easier at the school board level, where school boards hold a lot of decision-making power, for right-wing bigots who don't want to see progressive education to influence what's being taught. So easy. Part of what I've been doing during my role has been attending school board trustee meetings where they talk about queer issues, whether it's the raising of the flag, et cetera. And every time I've attended them, the people who are opposing motions that are progressive towards LGBTQ issues all have the same dog whistle. And that dog whistle, if we find out the connection, there are far right hate groups that are tied to like family values. I think there's like the Campaign for Life. There's another one for like Campaign for Family Values. I mean, I don't have their names top of mind, but I can send them to you. But they exist and they try to lobby school board trustees. We know this. And people don't think that school board trustees are as political or require the same political attention as maybe provincial elections or even municipal. But I would argue they absolutely do, because I even learned just this year that school board trustees can decide what books are brought into libraries. And we've seen this argument in the States around, you know, critical race theory and, you know, a book on anti-racism baby being a controversial issue. So that means here in Canada, that absolutely can happen here. And it has. I've also heard anecdotal stories of school boards out in the prairies in like Saskatchewan, where they had to mobilize progressive people to run for school boards because, especially in that area of the country, social conservatives, they were more pressed on what were young people learning. And they didn't want them to learn about queer trans people. And so now that Canada, so we're looking at nationally, provincially, territorially, now that we've seen many people in this country flirt out loud with the far right, if we're ever surprised that something like this could happen, I'd be like, have you learned nothing, folks? There is nothing within like Canadian political institutions that could prevent this from happening. And I often think about it from the flip side with regards to like progressive legislation, right? There's the dental care situation that's come up now with the NDP and the Liberals having a good time together, which is going to require provincial collaboration. Same thing with the childcare. What prevents that from being a far right issue, where that we're seeing that level of collaborating on legislation that targets provincial level, but supported by the federal government, where they can woo what we're now seeing? We have majority conservative provincial governments, if I'm correct. So if a populist, far right leaning conservative government got elected and was just like, we hate culture wars, you woke people are ruining everything, that could happen, because now there's the party line issue is not a thing no more. They could easily do that if they wanted to. I would argue that's probably where we would see the most collaboration between our provinces, our territories, and the federal government, is if that opportunity presented itself. I think it would happen. And I think it all goes back to the fact that we even saw the conservative government flirting with the far right out loud, publicly. And we know that there's been internal strife within the conservative government around defining who they are. Are they going to appeal to a fairly centrist majority country? Or are they going to really hold on to their base that is social conservative? And at a time where we are seeing a lot of pushback against progressive movements and legislation around the country. And so that's my whole explanation to answer the question that there's nothing preventing it. Actually, I think the environment is perfect for that to happen. I'm more of like a progressive person who does a lot of organizing in my own community. What are we going to do to ensure something like that doesn't happen? Learning from the lessons from the states, learning from activists from the states, but also learning from lessons for things that happened not even like 3 weeks ago. So that's kind of like how I see it, is that we do need to be better equipped to respond to this. It doesn't help to be reactive. We have to be really proactive.
And then just one other thought, if, you know, in one way that we're kind of seeing this rhetoric already kind of seep into our Canadian culture, if you will, was recently in the Olympics when a trans woman won the prize, and she has been completely delegitimized by the right and brought into question. And it's fascinating because these are the same people who don't care about income disparities in sports, or about Brittany Reiner being stuck in Russia right now, or about any of these other issues that actually do affect equity in sports. It's this veiled transphobia. And I'm wondering if you could maybe speak a little bit more to that.
I think you said it. In the sense that these people don't care about women's equity in sports. And as an athlete, I can speak from my own direct experience. They don't care. The world is very misogynist. And I think it shows its misogyny even further when trans women are involved, who are now being impacted by a very specific type of misogyny that is transphobic. Even sports as the medium for which that their bigotry gets spewed is a very interesting thing, because they want to go back to science, biology, going back to this very bioessentialist mindset that people who are assigned male at birth have this particular physiology. It all looks the same, very binary. Therefore, your gender has to look like this. And then the same thing for folks who are assigned female at birth. But even science has told us none of that even matters, because the diversity on like biology exists. I'm telling you now, I played rugby with some girls who would crush some men. The argument that this group is so different than that or much stronger is rooted on speculation and not much science. Yes, can we say that on average? Sure, if you want to use averages, but I think what's important to say is that there's diversity in it. And to be completely honest, we wouldn't be athletes if we weren't freaks of nature to begin with. And so like, for me, it goes back, because, you know, I went to university, I did a gender studies degree. These were things that I debated for 8 years in an undergrad and a master's degree. The average Canadian does not have access to the same type of thought and pedagogy that I embrace myself in, as well as the lived experience being a queer person, to be able to understand the dog whistles that they see in the news. For some other people, they don't know how to sift through that. If I think of my parents who are immigrants to Canada from an English-speaking country, but if you present something as this person is physically stronger than all of the other women that they've competed with, that's easily digestible to pull public opinion, to sway it more far right. And that's the problem. They pick what are the very easy ways to sway the majority of people who can't read through the bullshit. And that's why I think it's then the responsibility of those of us who are coming from progressive movements, those of us within queer community, to do that public education of teaching people to recognize what those dog whistles are, but then also making all of that theory and pedagogy I learned in university accessible to the like average Canadian, so that they are understanding that no, human beings are different. Sports is different. Understanding even the science of like hormones and its impact on people's bodies and like what that even means. Like, people don't understand that because it's never been made accessible. And I come from a civil society organization that plays a role in making that accessible to the broader Canadian public, right? And it can't just be civil society. It's our activists. It's our everyday people who are committed to fighting for the liberation of marginalized people so that we don't have to deal with it. But the far right is sneaky. They're cheeky. They know exactly what they're doing. And unfortunately, it's a formula that works. So we need to just be prepared to like fight against it.
Was a conversation between Rabble's Stephen Wenzel and Debbie Owusu-Icha of the Canadian Center for Gender and Sexual Diversity. Thank you very much for that, Stephen and Debbie. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. This week, Rabble's senior parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg poses the question, is Putin's resentment leading him to commit war crimes and genocide? There appears to be executions of hundreds of unarmed civilians in the Ukraine city of Bucha. This has caused worldwide outrage. Nirenberg wonders if we should be calling Russia's war on Ukraine a genocide. He writes, many world leaders are now saying the Russians are currently committing war crimes or crimes against humanity in Ukraine. Few have gone so far to use the stronger and more all-encompassing term, genocide. Although Ukraine's President Zelensky has. Zelensky asks, if the global body cannot intervene in a clear case of illegal invasion accompanied by a rising toll of vicious and brutal atrocities, of what use is the UN? He now proposes the world community should begin a criminal process to prosecute those responsible for the horror the Russians are inflicting on his people. Currently, nobody who opposes Putin has the wherewithal or power to do anything decisive to stop him, except, it seems, the Ukrainians themselves, Nirenberg writes. Someday, if the world is lucky enough, there will be a reckoning for the crimes committed during this war of aggression. In Canadian politics, Charlotte Dalwood dissects the rise in far-right populism in Canada, and nowhere is this clearer than in Alberta. Dalwood says that throughout the pandemic, Premier Jason Kenney has been kowtowing to the far-right minority. Kenney's rhetoric and public health measures were carefully orchestrated to appease this anti-establishment faction within his party, the alternative being to see the faction members topple his government, Dalwood writes. Whoever wins the UCP leadership review will no doubt have to do the same. Dalwood describes the right-wing populism currently on the rise in Alberta as energetic, vocal, and well-funded, a combination of factors that has allowed populist right-wing politicians and activists to hold Alberta's government hostage these past 2 years in spite of the views of the province's majority. Switching gears now to environmental news, David Suzuki wonders, will the world again hit snooze on the latest climate alarm? Suzuki analyzes mitigation of climate change, the third of the IPCC's 4-part 6 assessment. The report shows we've reached a critical point where slowing and stopping emissions is no longer enough. We have to remove some of what we've already pumped into the atmosphere, and that can mean using natural methods like forest protection and planting, as well as technologies like direct air capture. Procrastination is no longer an option, Suzuki writes. Every IPCC report since the first assessment in 1990 has been a wake-up call. We can't keep hitting snooze. Also on the site, Ole Hendrickson reviews The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money, and the Science of Deception by David Michaels. Michaels has written 2 books. The first, Doubt is Their Product, How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health, was written before Michaels' 7-year term at the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, or OSHA, during the Obama administration. The Triumph of Doubt is his most recent book, and one Hendrickson calls the most important worker health and safety post in the U.S. Hendrickson explains, in the book, Michael reveals how corporations continued to sell products that were harmful to people and meticulously documents how corporations and complacent government agencies debase science. Corporations hire product defense firms to relay regulatory and legal action when evidence emerges that their products and activities are causing harm to their workers, the public, and the environment. In the book, Michaels documents a range of tricks used by the pharmaceutical industry industry to get the products of questionable benefit through testing and onto the market, including funding many trials but publishing only those who make a drug look good, publishing results of a single trial many times and claiming that multiple studies reached the same conclusion, publishing the only part of a trial that yielded positive results, and testing a drug against a low dose of a comparison drug. You can catch all those stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca. And calling all labor pitches. Do you have a labor story based in the Greater Toronto area that you'd like to share with a national audience? Rabble.ca is teaming up with The Hoser and brand new Toronto publication, The Green Line, to commission an investigative labor story. We'll accept pitches on a range of labor-focused topics, including emerging and precarious workplace struggles, unionization, gig workers, unfair working conditions, and more. We are accepting pitches until Monday, April 11th. For more information, please visit rabble.ca/about/opportunities. And lastly, don't miss out. Next week, on Thursday, April 14th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, don't miss our next Off the Hill live politics panel. Joining us this month are MP Leah Gazan, longtime food activist and executive director of Food Share Toronto, Paul Taylor, documentary filmmaker and environmentalist, Avi Lewis, and Rabble senior parliamentary reporter, Carl Nirenberg. Co-hosting the event are Libby Davies and Robin Brown. This month's current affairs panel explores the real impact politics and policy have on people and on ways to mobilize and bring about progressive change in national politics, on and off the Hill. Do you have a question for one of our panelists? Ahead of the free panel, don't forget to register to save your spot for the event and get your chance to interact with our panelists through questions, polls, and more. You can find the registration link in our newsletter this week or on Rabble's Facebook page. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel and Carl Nirenberg for their reporting this week, and Carl, too, for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Shout out to the listeners at The Voice of Bombay, 95.9 and 98.1 FM in Newfoundland and Labrador this week. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.